It's a busy day in the city of Goa, late in the 16th century. We are standing in the Rua Diritia, Goa's most important commercial street. A gentle sea breeze ruffles our hair, bringing with it the smell of sea salt, river mud, and spice. Portuguese men stroll past us, dressed in colorful coats and baggy pantaloons, their heads covered with soft cloth caps. The wealthier among them are followed by Indian servants, usually dressed in little more than a loincloth, hurrying to keep an umbrella over their employer's head to shade them from the balmy sun. A pair of Indian women walk by. One of them has a short cloth wrapped over her shoulders and around her chest and waist. She wears thick earrings and bangles and is gently murmuring to a wailing child that she carries on her left arm. Another woman balances a pot on a folded cloth on her head, followed by an excited stray dog that she shooes away. A Portuguese man trots by on a handsome horse, accompanied by an Indian attendant in a robe and turban, who is beating a small drum and shouting to keep the crowds away. Three Indian maids ascend the stairs to a nearby street, dressed in Portuguese skirts with their heads covered. They accompany a carved wooden palanquin carried on the shoulders of two Indian men who wear a rather curious costume of Portuguese hats and coats with Indian loincloths and bare feet. All around us are homes in an architectural style that is very new to 16th century South Asia. Made of bricks, with their facades dressed in stone, they have two or three floors, tiled roofs, windows, and small balconies. On one of them, a child happily babbles as it looks at the noisy marketplace below. As we meander through this marketplace, hawkers call for our attention. Indian merchants wearing robes and turbans eye us cautiously. Everything is for sale: fish, spices, textiles, liquor. But something especially unique catches our attention. At a crowded stall, we see a craftsman holding up small white objects that a gaggle of merchants are clamoring to buy. As we look closer, we see in his hands, held in the long, agile fingers of a master artisan, ivory statuettes. The faces on these figures are unmistakably European. How did they come to be made by an Indian? And where are they intended to go? Welcome to the Altar of Time, a history of India's Christian art. My name is Kevin Fernandez. Of all the marvelous artifacts of Indo-Portuguese Christianity that we have seen in this podcast, Goa's ivories probably have the most remarkable global impact. For almost as long as Portugal ruled the region, dozens, if not hundreds, of beautifully carved statuettes were carried across the sea from Goa to Lisbon, and from there throughout much of Catholic Europe. In this episode, rather than focus on one particular object, we'll explore the interesting history of Indian Christian ivories, who made them, and how they went so far from their homeland. Ivory carving, as you can imagine, was not a craft that was practiced by the Portuguese before their arrival on the shores of South Asia. Within the subcontinent, though, ivory carving has a long and marvelous history. Some of the most remarkable examples of South Asian art are ivories, such as the Begram ivories produced in Afghanistan in the early centuries of the Common Era. And South Asian ivories have drawn the eyes of collectors and aristocrats for just as long. A particularly beautifully carved woman, known as the Yakshi of Pompeii, was discovered in the ruins of this Roman city, having been exported there across the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. When the Portuguese arrived in India, much of South Asia had an established ivory carving industry. This was especially so along the coast, where strangely enough, artisans used ivory sourced from East and Central African elephants rather than those from indigenous Indian elephants. It would seem that because of the Indian aristocracy's demand for war elephants and due to the lucrative nature of the trade, it was more economically practical to pull in raw material from across the ocean, where African peoples hunted elephants to sell their products to Indian buyers. Sadly, in the 16th century, we also know that warfare in parts of Africa was fueled by the need to capture slaves for military service in India's Deccan Plateau. In Gujarat and Sri Lanka, we know of the existence of large communities of ivory workers who made exquisite objects such as combs and furniture, carved with intricate geometric patterns, lush foliage, and beings from mythology. Not as much evidence survives for Goan ivory workshops. But this situation changed very soon after the Portuguese assimilated it into their Indian Ocean Empire. A major catalyst for Goan ivory production was the arrival of missionaries along the galleons of the conquerors. The Franciscan order was on the shores of India by 1510. By 1530, Goa had become a great commercial emporium and the center of administrative and military power. It was the headquarters of the Portuguese Patriarchate of the Orient and of monastic orders such as the Dominicans, Jesuits, and the Augustinians. This Rome of the East, as European travelers called it, exchanged goods of all sorts with Asia and Europe. Barely a decade later, the Portuguese were seeking to expand their footprint in other parts of South Asia, including Sri Lanka, where, as mentioned, a thriving ivory carving industry existed. The Sri Lankan ruler, Bhuvanayake Bahu, established an alliance with them to defeat his local rivals and sent his grandson to Lisbon for a symbolic coronation. With him went jeweled objects, folding fans made of ivory, and intricate caskets decorated with gems and gilded metal mounts. European aristocrats were obsessed with these caskets from the moment they first saw them. We know that they travelled from Lisbon to as far away as Germany by the late 16th century. This created a demand for more ivory objects, and Sri Lankan craftspeople quickly moved to provide them. The Asian Civilizations Museum in Singapore features a striking masterpiece produced by these ivory workers. It is a statuette of the Virgin Mary carrying the infant Jesus in one hand while blessing the viewer with the other. She wears a crown, gown, and a drape similar to a sari. The warm yellow ivory is brilliantly worked into folds to give the sense that she is enveloped in folds of cloth. Interestingly, both Mary and the infant Jesus wear a triple necklace, characteristic of Sri Lankan Buddhist ivories, suggesting that the craftsman originally applied an iconographic form he was used to this new divinity. Around the same time as this work was finished in Sri Lanka, Portuguese missionaries in India sought to convert more locals to Christianity. We'll talk more about the complex history of conversions in a later episode, but for now, we'll focus on statuettes. Gilded and painted statuettes of the Virgin Mary and Jesus and various saints were already being produced in Europe. These were used by Portuguese preachers to explain Christian mythology and theology, as well as gifts to local elites. It is possible that Sri Lankan ivories were gradually imported to fulfill this purpose, as they were closer to the cultural context of Goa than European wooden statues were. And both of these were then copied and replicated by local artisans. When the Mughal Emperor Akbar sent a diplomatic mission to Portuguese Goa in 1575, they found that the Goans were already producing devotional ivories, and some Goan craftsmen returned to Agra with the diplomats to work for the emperor. By the early 1600s, the Portuguese capital of Lisbon had become one of the grandest globalized cities of the world. Flooded with goods and people from South America and many parts of Asia, it rivaled older metropolises like Venice and Antwerp. From the Rua Nova do Mercadores, its main commercial street, sold rare and precious goods from across the world. A contemporary Portuguese saying goes, "Whoever does not see Lisbon does not see anything good." And among the most prestigious objects you could find in Lisbon were a steady increasing number of marvelous Goan ivory statuettes, many of which you can see today in the collection of the Museum of Christian Art in Old Goa. When they were first produced, Goan ivories were mostly copies of European originals brought by priests. But it was not long before workshops here found their own distinct visual language. Their subjects had rigid postures, robust bodies, and stiff angular features. These seem to have been inspired by contemporary South Indian bronzes, especially those produced by the Vijayanagar Empire. By the 17th century, when Goan ivories were a huge part of the roaring trade with Europe, they had much more naturalistic wavy hair and beautifully rendered clothing. As we'll see in other episodes of this podcast, Goan ivories usually have detailed pattern edges similar to textiles that Goan women wore at the time. These edges are often perforated, and the statuettes stand on bases decorated with acanthus leaves, similar to the vegetal motifs seen in both Hindu and Muslim Indian art. By the 18th century, naturalism had become the norm in Indian art, with fluid bodies that we can see in Goan ivories as well. This connection to Indian art at large would continue throughout the history of Goa. We will see a spectacular example of this in our episode about Nirmala Mata, an ivory statuette of the Virgin Mary that looks like a Hindu goddess. From Europe to Africa to Sri Lanka, Goan ivories are among the most cosmopolitan art objects of this most cosmopolitan region. They also show us, beyond the often touching stories and devotions that they inspired in their owners, that art never comes from a single place. From the elephant that bled out on the savannah to give us the ivory, to the preachers that commissioned the statuette in a state created by conquering adventurers, to the generations of masters who experimented and transmitted their knowledge, to the sailors that carried them on ships, and the buyers who competed in auctions in Lisbon to bring them to their warm homes, the ivories of Portuguese Goa, like all the marvels made by hands like ours across time, represent both the greatest and darkest impulses of our ancestors.